Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Project 223 podcast, back again from our studios in the Pacific Northwest here at the Eagle's Nest. We're glad to have you, and it's going to be a great podcast for August of 2023. We're going to do a little training recap for the class we were at over the weekend, doing a little instructing and learning. Also, we're going to talk about medical training in a preparedness mindset. We're going to talk about some leadership lessons learned and religion in mutual assistance group, its place, and when it's not to be of main focus. So buckle up and hold on, because it's going to be a great episode. Well, it's good to be back with you. It's been a little while, and it's been a busy summer, so I know you guys are all busy as well, but we're going to have a good show today. Talk a little bit about where we were at this weekend. Rifleman Camp by Training Northwest in Granite Falls, Washington. We had a great time helping out a little bit with the medical training portion and also taking part in some of the activities. We had a great time. You can go on the Training Northwest website at trainingnorthwestllc.com and read about that. There'll be more classes coming up there. There's always good stuff happening. This class was fun. It started out on Friday afternoon. Unfortunately, I couldn't get there till Saturday morning because of a previous engagement, but they went over Rifle One training, and these are their classes that they normally offer. They have these trainings regularly available. They put them all together in a three-day package. It was pretty fun. Did a Rifle One class. They did a defensive night perimeter, did a low light shoot with white lights, and then had a fireside discussion. And then you got a chance to use your gear camping out in the woods at their great location. Got some awesome facility there. Saturday morning, did some more rifle training than the Rifle 2 class. And then we started out with some first aid and medical training. We were able to do a little introduction for the guys on a basic level to TCCC, which stands for Tactical Combat Casualty Care. And that's the training that the military offers all their soldiers in how to stop massive bleeding and prevent deaths to a traumatic situation before that casualty gets to the hospital. They found out long ago that a lot of these deaths in the military and combat situations, they were preventable deaths, that people were dying before they got to definitive care, and that could have been prevented. And some of the things that caused those deaths were massive hemorrhage, right? Basically, the casualty bleeding out before they got to the hospital. That was like 90% of these preventable deaths. And then there was like 8 or 9% were dying due to a tension pneumothorax. And that's where you get a hole in your torso that allows air to vent in the space between your lungs and your chest wall. And so what that does is it collapses your lung, prevents you from being able to breathe properly, and that can cause death. And so that was also a preventative cause that they determined. And then there was about 1% that were dying due to a compromised airway. And so by making sure that somebody has a good airway, and one of their solutions to that was including the nasal pharyngeal airway in the individual first aid kits of soldiers. That's the little rubber tube that slides up into your nose, goes back down, and allows you to have an airway should you have some kind of compromise to your mouth or your jaw due to an injury or damage there. So those three things they determined could save a lot of lives if soldiers and people on the battlefield could stop people from bleeding to death, stop them from dying from a tension pneumothorax or not having a good airway. And so many of you have an individual first aid kit, especially if you're into the shooting sports, and you may have that on you should have that on your belt. Some of those items, those are where the origination for those items came from. So a tourniquet, having some hemostatic wound packing gauze, also having a chest seal, and also a nasopharyngeal airway. Those were items that were put in there for those specific reasons. So if you have those in your first aid kit and you don't know how to use them, then you need to get some training on that. There's tons of stuff to find on YouTube and on the internet, but there's no substitute for hands-on training. So that's what we did. We got the guys together, and we had some props that we built that simulated gunshot wounds and large lacerations. They were able to wound pack. We went over applying tourniquets on yourself and also on somebody else. And so that was a good time. One little note, if you have a tourniquet and you want to practice, make sure that you designate one of your tourniquets as a training tourniquet. They're actually only approved officially. They're recommended for a one-time use item. A lot of them are depend on Velcro, like the Cat 7 tourniquet depends on Velcro to give a good lock to it. And so if you use that many times over, they can start to wear out, and you don't want to have a tourniquet that's potentially worn and fatigued when it comes down to saving a life. So either buy a blue training tourniquet, and you can get those from North American Rescue. There's other websites that have them as well. But get a training tourniquet, a blue one that you can use, and that way you know it's a training tourniquet. Or just use your oldest one that you have. Write in white letters on it with like a white paint pen if it's black, training, and then make sure that you know that that's the one you use for that, because you need to do it over and over again to get the muscle memory down. So we talked about the TCCC. There's three phases in TCCC. The first phase is called care under fire. The second is tactical field care, and the third is tactical evacuation care. And on the basic level, we really focused on care under fire and then the beginning of the tactical field care. And when in care under fire, it's exactly what it sounds like. You're in a dangerous situation. Now, not all of you are going to be in combat situations or shooting guns, which is totally understandable. Most of us aren't. So another type of program that is developing is what they call TECC, stands for Tactical Emergency Casualty Care. And that focuses more on the first responder and civilian that is not necessarily in a combat role, but they also may find themselves in a situation where there was a mass shooter or some type of natural disaster where there's a significant number of casualties, and you need to respond to help those people in a dangerous situation. So that still a lot of the same principles apply. So in the first situation, the care under fire, that's when you're trying to render aid and there's still some type of emergency or threat that's happening at the time. And the main focus on that is stopping severe bleeding. And in the TCCC or TECC classes or program, they use what they call the MARCH algorithm, M-A-R-C-H, and that stands for massive hemorrhage, airway, respiratory, circulation, and the H is for hypothermia or head injuries. We're not going to go deep into that. We'll do that in another podcast down the road. But we're focusing mostly on the massive hemorrhage. And the reason why that's put out at the beginning of the algorithm is it doesn't matter if somebody has an airway or not. If they've got an arterial bleed in their leg and blood is spurting out, you can bleed to death from a wound like that in about 3 minutes. So we want to stop that blood as fast as possible, or nothing else really matters. So tourniquets are great for that application. They can be put on in 10, 15, 20 seconds, and you can quickly stop major bleeding in somebody's extremity. So that would be arms or legs, from the armpit, shoulder area down to the hand, also from the groin area of the leg down. You're able to take a tourniquet. You can, they put it on, we apply it in what they call a high and tight position. And that would be as far up as you can and as tight as you can. And so that way, no matter where that bleeding is in the arm or the leg, you're going to stop that bleeding quickly. And that's when you're in a dangerous situation. You're not going to be cutting off clothes. You're not going to be spending a whole bunch of time to analyze exactly where that is and decide if we want to go 2 to 3 inches above the wound or not. We're just going to go what they call high and tight, as far up as you can, and put that sucker on there. That'll stop that bleeding quickly. And then you're able to move that casualty from the dangerous area to a more safe place where you can spend more time dealing with the wound or injury. It used to be thought that tourniquets, once applied to somebody, would cause them to lose their limb, their arm, or their leg, and so it was called a last resort mode of treatment, but not anymore. Through the global war on terror, and the military has learned a lot, sadly, these lessons have been paid for in blood, but I'm glad that they've taken these lessons and have disseminated them to everybody to make sure that people are aware. You can have a tourniquet on somebody's arm or leg for many hours and still not cause significant damage to the limb. They've looked at even 4 to 6 hours when moving a casualty to a treatment area that still is not going to cause them to lose that limb. So it's important that we'd rather stop that. You got to stop that flow of blood, like we talked about earlier, to keep them from dying, get them to the definitive care, which means a higher level of care, whether that's a field hospital or an emergency room or whatever they may be. So tourniquets are now the first resort in the care under fire phase of TCCC. Once you've gotten the casualty out of the danger area, things can change a little bit. So in care under fire, first thing you're going to do, though, is return fire. If you're being fired at and you have the ability for self-defense, you have a firearm, you're going to fire back at that threat to try to stop it and make sure that you're able to be in a safe place to take care of your buddy. You're going to, if your buddy can help you out, if you are in a situation where they're armed as well, direct them to help you in returning fire. And then you're going to want to remove the casualty from the danger and get them to a place of relative safety. You want to, if you can, and there is a danger still existing, help your buddy apply the tourniquet on his own. Direct him to put it on himself if he's able to do that. It won't always happen, but you do it best you can. Once you've moved them to a safer place, whether that be a place of cover or away from the danger area, then you could reassess the injury and look at it. It might be that you can just apply direct pressure using a bandage and elevation to get the bleeding to stop, and then you don't need that tourniquet on. So it'll give you time, once you're in a safer location, to do more assessment of the wound and decide if the tourniquet's needed. If the bleeding is not massive, you don't want to have a tourniquet on for long periods of time. How do you know if a bleeding is massive? How do you know if a tourniquet's warranted? Well, there's a few things that you can look for. One is a spurting of the blood. You can tell that it's arterial bleeding if the blood is pulsating or squirting out. It'll be, you know, 1, 2, 3, kind of like at the same rate their heart is beating. Because what's actually happening is the heart is beating. It's pushing that blood out that broken artery, and it's spurting out. Somebody can bleed to death very quickly from a wound like that. That's one indication. Another one would be a large pooling of blood underneath the victim or the person that you're trying to help. If you see a pool growing that's 12, 14 inches in diameter, you know that's massive bleeding. And also another indication would be their clothing starting to become soaked with blood, especially in the wintertime when people have heavier layers on. You may not be able to see blood spurting out or see it pooling, but you would see it soaking into their clothes significantly. Now, I'm not talking just a little spot of a few inches, but a whole, you know, portion of their leg, whether it's their thigh or their upper arm or lower arm, a significant portion of their clothing starting to be soaked with blood. You could assume that's massive hemorrhage. When in doubt, put the tourniquet on high and tight, tighten it down, get them to a place of safety, and then you can reassess the wound. So that's just a few little nuggets that we talked about in our class training. We also did some wound packing. We had some simulators there on site and allowed the guys to take some gauze and used wound packing gauze to simulate packing a wound and then bandaging those wounds up so that they can transport the casualty to a higher level of care. It was a great time, wonderful people in these classes, and I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. So check out trainingnorthwest.com and see if you can find some classes that might interest you. One of the other lessons that I learned in the class that was reinforced to me was how important leadership is in the team environment. There was a scenario that we did where we had two-man bounding with live fire, and the two-man team would bound up, and then they covered a casualty who was down and called up the medic team. And a two-man CASEVAC team, that'd be a casualty evacuation team, moved up from the rear with their portable fabric gurney and their medical gear, grabbed the victim that was had a gunshot wound, and was able to pull them back out of danger. Now, there was a couple lessons learned here. Although we had trained on tourniquets just the day before, many people had some struggles when it came to putting the tourniquet on in a stressful situation. This will be the case often. When you are in stressful situations, your heart beats up, you're breathing rapidly, you'll find that doing manipulation of fine motor skills is a little more difficult. And so unless you've trained many, many times on putting a tourniquet on, when it comes time for the stressful situation, you may experience some difficulty. So by doing the application, by practicing tourniquet applications over and over and over, doing it the same way every time, that when it comes time for the stressful situation, you'll be able to do it without having any problems. So that's one lesson that was learned. Another lesson that was reinforced in my mind was how important it is to have leadership in a team environment. When the teams came together that came up and didn't have a clear leader designated, sometimes there was a little awkward movements, and it wasn't quite clear who was making the decisions on what they were going to do. And so this can cause some problems. I encouraged the guys to designate one of the pair to be the leader of the buddy team. That way, when it came time to making decisions like how they were going to drag the victim or which way they're going to roll the victim, that person could be the one that made that call. So it's always important to have a clear leader designated. And not only just in a small team like that in that situation, but in any type of group that you're in, whether that be a CERT team, a mutual assistance group, a preparedness group, or anything of that nature where you have a mission and a goal that you're trying to accomplish, leadership is important. If everybody's doing their own thing and nobody is in charge, then it makes it hard to make clear decisions on which way to go. And that doesn't mean that you have somebody that's a boss that's telling people what to do. It means somebody that's more of a service position that's able to make decisions that will help everybody. And when there's confusion or you need to get a group consensus, that person can help work that out and make a clear decision. So leadership is very important. Also organization. You need to know what your purpose is, where you're going, and how you're going to get there. It's also important to be like-minded with the people you surround yourself with. And that brings us to another topic. And we've experienced some of this recently in a group that I'm a part of. And that is, what's the role in a mutual assistance group of religion or personal beliefs? And how does that affect your mission? You really need to think about, in any group you're in, what is the primary purpose of the group? Now, if somebody's in a small group at their local church or something of that nature, that's a little different. You're obviously going to be some people that are aligned specifically on the purpose of following your God, living out your personal religious beliefs. But in a mutual assistance group or a preparedness group, it may be a little different. You may not want to limit yourself to only those people that think exactly like you do when it comes to spiritual issues, but you may think of something more along the lines of focusing on the things you have in common, like freedom and liberty. The importance of what our founding fathers set up in this country is people can believe the way they want to believe, and they're not going to be persecuted for their personal religious beliefs. And that's the way it should be. You should have your own choice to make that decision. It shouldn't be forced on you by anybody. And it shouldn't be forced on you to not have religious beliefs. So many times, whether it be in the schools or other public arenas, they'll try to pull the separation of church and state. But really, that is not something that was designed to keep religion out of the public square, but it was to prevent the government from actually designating a state-sponsored religion. Every man and woman has the right to believe the way they want and to take their personal beliefs into the public square, as long as those beliefs don't encroach on other people's rights or liberties. And so, in a mutual assistance group, if your focus is helping each other out in times of disaster or emergency, if your focus is on trying to be prepared for disasters and helping each other train for those things, then there's no reason why differences in personal religious beliefs should limit you in that area. And quite the contrary, if you're a person who has strong beliefs and thinks that they are valuable and that you'd like other people to see those beliefs, well, then you should ideally want to have people around you that can see the way that you live, not in such a way where you preach at them and try to tell them they're wrong and you're right. But I like what the Bible says in Matthew 5:13-16. And this is directed specifically at the person who calls themselves a Christian. Our podcast is out for anybody of any personal belief that you have. But obviously, we focus on God and believing in that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world, and we love Him, and that He's the way to have eternal life. But you don't have to be a Christian person to believe in the tenets of preparedness and self-reliance. So we like to have all comers on the Project 223 podcast. In Matthew 5:13, it says, like I said, this is for the Christian listener. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Remember, this is Jesus talking. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, you Christian man, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. And I like that. It doesn't say so that they may hear your good works. It says so that they can see your good works. So if I'm not living in a way that people can see the kind of person I am and the character that I exhibit, then that's the first step. Let them see your good works. And if somebody's interested and the conversation comes around, you can share your personal beliefs. But just be aware that you need to respect other people's beliefs and not put them down if you expect to have a relationship and them to be respectful of what you believe. When the primary purpose of your group is mutual assistance and fighting for the cause of liberty and freedom, then for us, it's if people are willing to live by the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, treat people with respect and kindness the way you want to be treated, then that's the main focus for our group as far as the way that we treat each other. We have people of different religious beliefs, different mindsets, different philosophies, and that's okay. Just be aware that there may be those people that have different beliefs than you, and so make sure that you are somewhat like-minded in those things and that keep the primary focus in mind. If you look out there, a lot of the people on the other side, the socialists, the communists, the left that fight against us and fight against liberty and freedom, they work together quite a bit for a common goal. And they put aside, even though a lot of them have very different beliefs and mindsets, they work together to try to accomplish their goals, and that's to come against liberty and freedom. And those of us that would believe in the concept of the Constitution and the United States of America as the greatest nation on God's green earth. So just be aware of those things, something to think about. Well, that's all for today on the Project 223 podcast. Hope you enjoyed some information on tactical combat casualty care, our review of the Rifleman Camp that's run by Training Northwest, and also some leadership lessons learned. Hope you have a great rest of the week. We'll be talking to you again soon. Thanks for joining us. Remember, The wise man prepares, but the fool keeps going and suffers. Don't let your buddy bleed to death.